Well, good evening. It's delightful to be here in Melbourne and come and talk to you all and share some of the experiences I've had over these last few months, particularly May, which certainly turned out to be a very interesting month. What I'm going to do is talk about my shuttle flight, STS-77. This is where the fun really started. This is May the 19th, about 6:30 in the morning, Florida time, when we launched STS-77, and I had the privilege to ride on the flight deck up behind the window you see there on the right, and I was watching down into the flame trench at all those rather interesting things taking place below me. Okay, for us, the flight began about 5 hours before launch. We were woken up at about 1:30 in the morning, and we went into the suit-up room adjacent to our crew quarters and donned these suits, which provide protection for us in the event of a high-altitude bailout. They're pressure suits. We call them launch entry suits. And here you can see the various crew members checking, putting their suits on, checking them, checking the helmets and the communication systems, and preparing for flight. And once the suits have been checked out and we know they're operational, we then leave the vehicle, the building, and walk out to the bus, which takes us to the launch pad. This is the same walk that the Apollo astronauts made when they went to the moon. Once we get to the launch pad, at the top of the launch pad, we go into this little room adjacent to the cabin. We don the communication caps and parachutes and survival gear, crawl in, put our helmets on, strap in, and we're ready to go. At about 6 seconds before launch, the main engines are started. They run up to speed, and they check pressures and temperatures, what we call red line limits, to make sure that the engines are operating satisfactorily. If the engines are working, then the solid rocket boosters are ignited. At that point, we're totally committed for flight. The large bolts, 8 of them, which are holding the entire 5.5 million pound assembly to the launch pad, are exploded, and that releases it into flight, and it climbs up from the launch pad very quickly. We climb higher and higher into the atmosphere. As we get into the dense parts of the atmosphere, we actually, because we're going quite fast, we actually throttle back the main engines somewhat to reduce the acceleration loads. Once we climb above about 50,000 feet, we throttle them up to full speed again. At this point, the entire vehicle is consuming fuel at a rate of about 12 tons a second. This is really a spectacular sight. If you ever get to see a shuttle launch, I encourage you to do it. At about 2 minutes into the flight, the solid rocket boosters have depleted their fuel. They're blown away from the stack, and we then climb up on the main engines up to 3G acceleration for 8.5 minutes and reach our orbital velocity of 28,000 kilometers an hour. As soon as we get onto orbit, we have to go to work straight away. First order of business is to open the payload bay doors that you see here. This is a view from the flight deck looking into the cargo bay of the orbiter. And these are the doors which are opened on orbit. And that's important because these doors have lined with radiator panels, and these provide essential cooling for the crew compartment and all the electronics equipment that we carry on board. So it's very important we get them open quickly to maintain the right temperatures in the vehicle. You can see here the orbital maneuvering engines that I talked about, the tail of the orbiter. And there in the foreground was the satellite that we're going to deploy. This, of course, is the spectacular aspect of spaceflight, which is when you open the doors and the windows and you see this amazing view. And this is coming across the Indian Ocean, heading southeast towards Australia. We have to take off the suits that we put on a couple of hours before on the ground. And that's a real challenge when you're just getting accustomed to microgravity. It's quite a flail to learn to work in weightlessness. My responsibility, as you see here, was to activate the space hab module during this time as well. So I had to go in and equalize the pressures, make sure the pressures were equalized in the airlock, open up the hatch, and go into the space hab module, as you can see there, where all these experiments were mounted that we operated throughout the mission. While I was doing that, the pilot of the mission was assembling this you see here, which is a cycle ergometer, an exercise bike basically, which we carried on orbit, because it's very important when you're on orbit to exercise regulate to try and mitigate some of the effects of zero gravity because you're not using leg muscles and they tend to get very stiff when you come back on the ground. So it's important to exercise on a fairly regular basis. Then we came to flight day 2, and that's when we really got going on the flight. Here we're going to deploy this satellite, this Spartan satellite, and the inflatable antenna on it. And to do that, we're using the remote manipulator arm you see here. We're operating this from the aft flight deck, and this is a view looking aft. Actually, this is at night. Remember, in orbit, you get a night and day every 90 minutes, 16 sunrises and sunsets every day. So this is in a night pass. And what we're doing is driving the arm down here over this fixture that's on the satellite. And this is a grapple fixture with a pin on it and a target. And we actually come down and ensnare the pin and form a rigid connection to the satellite. We then unlatch the satellite from the payload bay and hoist it up out of the payload bay, as you can see here. And we are up behind these windows here performing this operation. And then we've sent some remote commands to set it on its auto sequence. And while we're doing this, we're flying over Egypt. This is the Nile River over Egypt that you can see here. Once we were satisfied that the satellite was intact and survived the launch loads, we then released it. Now we're back on a night pass, and you can see the atmosphere and the terminator, the sunset of the Earth over here. And to do that, we just release the snares and slowly back the arm away, leaving the satellite free-floating. And once it's clear, then we fire jets on the orbiter to back the orbiter away to a safe distance from the satellite so it could begin its automatic sequence of this inflation, which is now beginning. And it begins by canisters opening here and this large silver balloon-like structure being ejected out into space, into free space, so that an inflation sequence could begin. And remember, what this is going to be is a canopy with three tripod legs. It's a bit like a parachute, actually. And you can see here the three legs that make up the support tripod, and all of this structure out here is the canopy of this antenna. And antennas like this have a lot of application. They can be used for communication, they could be used for radar mapping, they could be used for deep space probes, they could be used for sunshades on a space station. And the advantage of them is that you could make a really large structure with something that starts out quite small and low weight. And now you can see the inflation starting. You see these lines filling with dry nitrogen gas. It's a bit like water being pumped into a fire hose. Here's the second one. Now, I need to give some perspective of scale of this. These legs, when they're fully inflated and extended, are about 30 meters long. This canopy here, when it unfurls, will be about 15 meters across. So it's about the size of a tennis court. So this was a very, very big structure. I mean, it was easily visible from Earth. It was like a giant silver mirror tracking along next to the orbiter. Now, we also had a camera on board here. And in a moment, you'll see a view from the camera that this system was carrying, looking out at this inflation sequence. And just gives you a different perspective of the whole thing. It's black and white, but it's still quite a nice perspective. For those of you who know California, we're just doing this as we're flying over Edwards Air Force Base, the dry lake beds of Edwards Air Force Base, just north of Los Angeles. There, it's nearly fully inflated now. There are some gyrations on the satellite with the inflation, but there's a control system which stabilizes those out. Okay, this is the view from onboard the satellite as all of that material is being ejected out into space. And this is quite nice. I like it because you can see the limb of the Earth there. And there you see the large silver mirror we form. And here's a nice view of it. This is what it looked like fully inflated. It's really an impressive sight. We tracked it for an orbit, and then we cut this Spartan loose from it and let it go, and you'll see the ejection sequence in a moment. But this was really a beautiful sight from orbit. We're only 70 meters away from it, so we're really very close to it. And this is a view on board as it was rotating, and you can see it took a picture of us. And the flash was some of the jets firing on the orbiter, I think. And you can see the orbiter tracking up there. And we are on board that spaceship. Okay, next comes the ejection sequence where we ejected it from the carrier. And I want you to look at the canopy here, just there. And you can see the jolt the whole canopy feels. It's like a big drum being hit. And now you can see the carrier has been released. And it was the little pyrotechnics firing that caused the jolt, which showed up as that beautiful wave traveling across that big canopy. we couldn't bring this antenna back because it was just too big. And if you think about it, in zero gravity and in a vacuum, you can't deflate a structure like this. There's no way you could wrap it up and bring it back. So we left it there. And it actually burned up a couple of days later. A day later, I think, re-entered the atmosphere. But we did have to go back and get the small satellite that had carried it up there. And this is what we're doing here. This is a view as we're approaching it through an optical alignment sight that we use to help guide the orbiter in. Because it's a very tricky operation. You've got to come up to it very carefully and get just in the right position and then bring the remote manipulator arm you see here up to the satellite, which is over on the left. And we do this by operating these controls on the aft flight deck, which let us actually, the little joysticks, and they actually let us fly the arm in using this target, which is carried on the satellite, as the visual cue of this cross here. And that's the visual cue used to bring the arm in and latch onto it. But you have to be very careful because you don't want to bump the satellite before you snare it, because if you bump it, it's going to start tumbling. And if it starts tumbling, it's never going to stop and you'll never be able to retrieve it. So it was a fairly delicate operation to come in and grasp this satellite, which weighs probably 800, 900 pounds, and do it without bumping it and get a good rigid connection to it. And that was something that Marc Garneau did and did very well too. And there you can see that's what's happening here once again during a night pass. Once we had it, we then rotated it around above the orbiter to make sure that it had integrity, that it hadn't been damaged in any way, because we wanted to make sure it was absolutely safe to bring this back. And it was, so we then latched it down into the payload bay of the orbiter here using the arm. This was a very busy time on the flight deck. And you can see we're all up there watching the operation progress. We were pretty pleased when we got done with it, so we cranked the arm up into the shape of a 7 and used a split screen to send that down to the ground to show the flight controllers our mission number. Okay, now this is about flight day 3. This is the second small satellite we deployed. Actually, I got to deploy this one. You can see there it is. We ejected it from the payload bay down towards the Earth at a very low velocity. And then we backed away from it very carefully and monitored it for 3 days while it was in orbit about 2,000 feet from us, because what we're trying to look at is see how it reacts in orbit. And this is a view of it here crossing over the west coast of Africa. Here is the entrance to the Mediterranean. Gibraltar's under that cloud somewhere. This is Morocco, and Portugal is up there. It's a pretty impressive sight, as you can probably imagine. The Mediterranean was a grand sight from orbit. So we had to track this very carefully for 3 days and move the orbiter just to track its motions. So that was a very delicate piece of flying. And one of the aids we used to do that is this handheld laser here, which we used to irradiate the target and measure the range to the target as well as its velocity relative to the orbiter. And we used that information, which is taken into these down that cable to these laptop computers you see here, where guidance computations are made to determine how to move the orbiter, how many jets to fire, and which ones, in order to get the right relative motion to the satellite. And we did that for 3 days, and it did indeed adopt a stable attitude. And this is just a view of it taken 2,000 feet away with a big lens during a night pass. Like I said, it's still up there and it'll come down next year. Okay, other activities during the mission were operating these experiments that I talked about. And this is actually one of the crystal growth experiments that Marc Garneau is operating here. And we're looking to grow semiconductor crystals in space with this facility. Myself and mission specialist Dan Bursch moving around in weightlessness, operating the various experiments that we carried on board in the Space Hab module. So this is back in the payload bay of the Space Hab module that we carried. It was really a good working environment. It expanded our useful volume by nearly a factor of 2, actually. This is the mid-deck area that it was connected to. And this is Mario Runco activating one of the small experiments that we had. And I draw your attention to the sleep bags that you see behind. And this is how we sleep. You would just put one of these sleeping bags anywhere you could find, the wall or ceiling, and crawl in and go to sleep. This demonstrates one of the unique things about being in microgravity or weightlessness. You can just have things float in front of you. This is just water floating in front of Marc Garneau. He's actually squirted a little bubble of air inside it, so it's actually an air bubble inside a water drop. And that's what was amazing. You could just do these things and they just float in front of you. Okay, this is a typical mealtime. On the mid-deck of the orbiter, here's the crew and Commander John Casper showing off a bit, upside down. You could really play some interesting psychological tricks by being in weightlessness. And now I've got a few shots that show just sort of the day-to-day activity on the orbiter. The flight deck you saw a moment ago, and this is the aft flight deck. This is exercising. I mentioned exercise is very important on orbit to mitigate the effects of zero gravity has on the muscles. So we had to exercise on this bike just about every day for 20 or 30 minutes. And Mario Runko, my crewmate here, is stowing a vacuum cleaner that he's just done some housekeeping with. This is how you sleep. You just crawl into this bag, Velcro your head to the pillow, go to sleep. And we use an eye shade, of course, because you get a sunrise every hour and a half. But to my great surprise, it was remarkably easy to sleep in space. It really was. And Dan Bursch here is just discovering the challenge of inserting contact lenses in zero gravity. Apparently it went all right. Okay, now this is a view that some of you may recognize. This greeted us every morning, coming across the Indian Ocean, the west coast of Australia. Perth is down here somewhere, and Exmouth Bay. It was a striking sight because of the contrast of the blue ocean and the red desert. Night passes over land look like this. The lights you see are city lights. This is actually North Florida. And the flashes you see are electrical storms, and you could see these amazing displays of lightning that would start on a storm front and propagate like a row of dominoes falling over all the way along the storm front. And this is California. This is Baja, California. San Diego's up here somewhere under these clouds, coming down southeast over the arid zones of Mexico. After 10 days, our mission came to an end, so it was necessary to prepare the vehicle to return into the atmosphere. To do that, we had to close the payload bay doors and latch them down. We then, as crew members, had to go and don the high-altitude pressure suits that we wear for launch and entry, shown here, and it's a challenge in zero gravity. But it's made worse after 10 days because your spine has actually expanded. You're about an inch or so taller, and in zero gravity, the suit's a bit of a squeeze. We then fire the orbital maneuvering engines that reduces our velocity and causes us to start to fall back into the atmosphere. And this is the view outside the window as we hit the atmosphere, moving at a speed of Mach 25. The whole vehicle glows red hot, the whole outside is incandescent, and we shed these bright flashes of plasma. You can see the outside window, it's all hot outside. Gravity doesn't just suddenly increase, it slowly increases, as you can see as he's dropping this card. It's just getting a little more and more gravity as you come into the atmosphere. The re-entry is fully automated until about 50,000 feet. At that point, the commander takes manual control of the vehicle and starts manually flying and turns a large circle to align with the runway. This is, at this point, the world's heaviest glider. It weighs 100 tons, you're moving at about 300 knots. You only get one shot at the landing because this is an unpowered descent. You come down very steeply in a glide. At 5,000 feet, you pre-flare to slow your speed down. At about 500 feet, you flare to further slow your speed down to about 200 knots. And the pilot fires the pyrotechnics, which deploy the landing gear. You cross the threshold and land at a speed of about 200 knots.